Hello, I'm Lauren Gonzalez, part of the Bureau of Justice Assistance body-worn camera team, and today I'm speaking with Adam Rosenberg as part of our podcast series. Mr. Rosenberg is currently the executive director for the Baltimore Child Abuse Center, dedicated to providing victims of child abuse with comprehensive forensic interviews, medical and mental health treatment with a goal of preventing future trauma. Mr. Rosenberg was the first male prosecutor to join the domestic violence unit of the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. He frequently testifies, lectures, conducts audits, and runs workshops for youth services regarding sexual child abuse. Today, Mr. Rosenberg will give us his perspective on body-worn cameras in relation to juveniles. Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Rosenberg.
Thank you, Laura.
I want to open up the conversation on the issue of privacy and juveniles. As you often use videos for your interviews, what do you find to be the biggest difference between the way your organization uses these recordings and the way law enforcement officials use the footage from their body-worn cameras?
So there's a few things that make this different and perhaps even some similarities as well. Every child that we interview at our center is digitally recorded, and you know we're recording the conversation between a forensic interviewer and a child who's been suspected of being a victim of abuse or some witness to crime. Mm-hmm. I think the one of the big differences is that the system is hardwired into the room so that there's no recording taking place until the child is physically in the room. So we're making everybody aware of the fact that there are recordings going on prior to being introduced to the camera itself. We're letting caregivers know, parents or other caretakers, and then once the child's in the room, we're very much pointing out that the room is recorded for sound. I think that's a big difference from the situation where a body-worn camera suddenly appears at a house or at an incident, and that the presence of the camera is sort of introduced into the room versus bringing the suspect, the victim, to the camera. I think that's one of the big differences there. We're bringing someone to the camera versus bringing the camera to them. That's one of the big differences there, and maybe it doesn't sound like much, but I think it's in terms of how it's phrased in there. Look, the second difference, I think, in some ways is that the camera's on a fixed point, so it's really taking a very static image of what the room sees versus body-worn camera, which is obviously moving and is almost the officer's perspective. So, as the officer's body turns, officer's going to be capturing other information there. So the footage from the body-worn camera is going to be capturing the entire scene versus just, the one-on-one interaction between a forensic interviewer and a child. At least with our system, our rooms not only are recording, but the feed is sent into a viewing room where police officers and child protective services and mental health professionals and prosecutors are both watching the interview and interacting with the interviewer through an earbud. So, where the interview on a body-worn camera is just a very unscripted, live interaction there, the forensic interview that's recorded is really different in the sense that it's a structured conversation. There is dialogue going back and forth between, or really going one way, between the people watching the interview and the interviewer who has to do the difficult feat of asking questions, listening to a child, and hearing someone talk in her ear about, what other questions to be asking there. So they're able to direct the conversation and provide information for the interviewer versus the body-worn camera, which, really is capturing very raw footage. That's a significant difference too there, as to how they're capturing these issues.
Absolutely.
I think going a little bit further about, capturing sensitive issues is the body-worn camera, with law enforcement, I guess some of it depends on which law enforcement officers have a body-worn camera. Is it all police? Is it only patrol? That typically in child abuse or domestic violence cases, specialty units, detectives are coming on the scene, and, you know, in some jurisdictions, it's my understanding that they don't necessarily have body-worn cameras. So the arrival of a special unit may not be capturing that footage in the same way that a patrol officer may be.
Right.
And conversely, those patrol officers or those first responders who are capturing footage there, there's a risk inherent, especially when dealing with child witnesses there, that one, I think it's capturing, you know, the entire scene as it plays out. So from a prosecutor's standpoint, we're able to, if we can use that footage, able to more adequately convey to a jury, to a fact finder, what's actually transpiring there. We can give a sense as to the chaos that was present in a domestic violence scene or the chaos that was present in a child sexual assault, because the body-worn camera is going to be able to not just see the victim, but also see the room. You know, very different than the forensic interview camera, where it's a child retelling what happened to them. This is present sense impression. This is really live footage of a child's potential first disclosure to a first responder. And so I think they're able to capture a lot of real raw emotion that may not necessarily manifest itself or may manifest itself very differently in the safety and security of a forensic interview room. I mean, you'll get crying, you'll get tears, you'll maybe get nothing. You may get no child talking because they're just so stunned and overwhelmed by what they just saw. The other caution with body-worn cameras when a first responder shows up on a scene with victims is making sure that the first responder understands what their responsibility is when it comes to talking to children and to victims. It's not their role to conduct a full-blown interview of the child, but rather to collect what we refer to as minimal facts, having a minimal facts intervention. So they really need a good understanding about what are the very basic things they should be talking to a child or a victim about, and then knowing that once they've received an allegation of something's occurred, they're able to then contact their local children's advocacy center or their specialty units to conduct follow-up. Those are the real experts who know how to talk to kids and are instructed to be able to get the information available there using national standards and protocols. The first responder who asks too many questions or asks leading questions could be accused of putting words in a kid's mouth, and that's great fodder for, you know, for any defense attorney to be able to state that the child was, you know, that the child was suggested as to what had happened there. First responders need to know that if they're using body-worn cameras when they meet these kids for the first time, they really don't want to be asking too many questions because they don't want to be prejudicing or biasing what actually happened in the case, because now we'll have two recordings available as to what happened to that kid from the body-worn camera and from the subsequent forensic interview. And the subsequent forensic interview is really where the meat of it comes up there.
Absolutely. Well, I think that ties in really well to my next question, which is, how exactly do you balance a victim's right to privacy with the need to capture information as evidence?
I think that's a tough question. And I think that, you know, we're balancing, I think you used the right word there, we're balancing, you know, these different things there that quite often if we do this right, you know, if we capture the right evidence and the right statements, oftentimes we may not even need a victim to testify at trial because we'll have terrific footage from a scene, whether it's, you know, visual representation of bruises or the, you know, the very perceived, you know, you may even catch the act on film, and, you know, if an officer shows up and, you know, sees that, you know, the man is striking the kid at that moment in time, you've caught it there. But that said, though, is, you know, I think there is some privacy that you'll come across, you know, situations that with very delicate moments there, that people in, you know, in various states of undress, nudity, and I think that in some ways, you know, may could be inappropriate to capture there, that we don't want to be capturing people's their own genitals and private parts there, and I'm not that they have that right to privacy. At the same time, though, obviously it presents a good case for a prosecutor to be able to say, this is what my officer saw. I think that we have to be careful about what happens with that footage as well, because of those scenes of chaos, we don't want ending up on Fox News or some other media outlet. We want to be able to make sure that they are protected, with tight, rigid standards there, so that as these videos are turned over during discovery, that we put strict restrictions on them as to how they're able to be viewed, and maybe we're making the videos accessible, but we're not necessarily make them available for take home usage there. There are probably some victims who, don't want to be recorded and don't want to be talking about it on camera. And I think we have to figure out, how do we balance that, in an age that I think the goal is to leave the body-worn camera running to be able to capture the whole scene for both the protection of the subject of the video as well as the officer. And that becomes, a difficult moment, perhaps even one that we don't want as a foil, right, to the situation. Right. We wouldn't want someone to say, well, my kids are here, turn off the video, and then there's an allegation of some sort of officer misconduct. Right. So I think that, departments need to be able to come up with standards as to, what happens when you come up upon a scene that there are certain circumstances that may necessitate turning the camera off, or is the camera always on? And I think that that's something for a department to grapple with. It's going to be much more than just interactions on the street, but there'll be a lot of kids and there'll be a lot of raw instances occurring there. I think one of the interesting parts also in terms of right of privacy and capturing information, which may not necessarily have been thought of with the advent of the body camera, but that if we're reviewing the footage afterwards, so if there's an incident, a domestic incident, and officers appear upon the scene and the camera's rolling, that the camera's not just capturing the interaction between the officer and the subject, but captures the entire setting and room. So if you've come upon a suspected domestic violence, a suspected child abuse, but there's visible evidence of narcotics dealing, guns or whatever, other illegal activity, one has to wonder, what can we do with that? And vice versa, that if they're coming upon one set of crimes and there's children present in the room, I think we want to be able to capture that there.
Right.
I think the bottom line is, with anything, I think it's coming up with a policy and then figuring out how it evolves from there. So the local jurisdictions need to have need to be able to commit to some form of writing, in my opinion, what their policy would be if upon coming on a scene there are children present or there's allegations of abuse present or there are other things, so then their officers know what to do, as opposed to the officer making a decision in their own best judgment, which in the end isn't the best interest of the case. If the officer says, well, I turned off the camera because the woman asked me to, or there was a child that was naked, or whatever it is. But I think that it's really got to stick with what the policy needs to be versus what one's discretion is at that point there, so that we're consistent in what we're doing and what we're not doing.
Absolutely. I agree. I think that delineating policy and procedures is very essential for these sensitive issues.
This concludes part one of BJA's Body Worn Camera podcast with Mr. Adam Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Boston Children's Abuse Center. Part two will be broadcast in the next episode, so be sure to tune in next time for the conclusion of this podcast. And as always, please remember to visit the Body Worn Camera Toolkit at www.bja.gov/BWC and submit your ideas for new content through the BWC support link at the bottom of the homepage. Thank you for listening today.